This spring, if you'd rather spend time enjoying your lawn instead of trying to keep it alive, there's good news. TruGreen is the easiest and most affordable way to get a beautiful lawn. All you have to do is water and mow, and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and even some things you might not even think of. They'll do all of it, while you can do literally anything else. With True Green, you could have your lawn looking as good as a putting green. That's not hyperbole. True Green is the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour. True Green offers a satisfaction guarantee, and they have a verified best price promise, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people guaranteed.
This episode is brought in part to you by Audible, your go-to destination for thrilling audio entertainment. Whether you're looking for a hair-raising experience to enjoy while you're on the move or eager to dive into sinister and shocking tales, Audible has an exclusive collection of thrillers from best-selling authors that will keep you on the edge of your seat. Like James Patterson's first audio-only thriller, The Coldest Case. Experience stories like never before, where every chilling detail is brought to life by captivating sound design. Plus, as an Audible member, choose one title a month to make yours forever. And now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Just visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500.
A story of betrayal you would struggle to believe if it wasn't true. Listen to Blood is Thicker, the Hargan family killings, early and ad-free on Wondery Plus.
I'm Margaret Brennan in Washington, and this week on Face the Nation, the Biden administration mounts an aggressive diplomatic offense at an international security conference, and former President Jimmy Carter enters end-of-life hospice care. Just ahead of its one-year anniversary, the war in Ukraine was the top item on the agenda at the annual Munich Security Conference, with U.S. diplomats publicly blasting the Russians and Vladimir Putin.
We have examined the evidence. We know the legal standards. And there is no doubt these are crimes against humanity.
Privately, Secretary of State Antony Blinken had a, quote, candid and direct, code for confrontational, meeting with his Chinese counterpart about the spy balloon. We spoke with him right after that.
It's safe to say there was no apology.
We'll bring you that interview, plus a conversation with Senator Bernie Sanders. And we'll take a closer look at the nation's mental health crisis and the hospitalization of Pennsylvania Senator John Fetterman for depression. It's all just ahead on Face the Nation. Good morning and welcome to Face the Nation. We've got a lot of news to get to today, but last night we learned former President Jimmy Carter has decided to spend his remaining time with his family in Plains, Georgia, in home hospice care. The 98-year-old Carter is the oldest surviving president, and our Bob Schieffer will be along later in the broadcast with some insights. But we want to turn now to that hour-long meeting between Secretary of State Blinken and his Chinese counterpart, Wang Yi, the first face-to-face meeting since the U.S. shot down the Chinese spy balloon 2 weeks ago. We spoke with the secretary last night from Munich, just after that meeting. Mr. Secretary, I know you just met with your Chinese counterpart, Wang Yi, who has publicly said the U.S. response to the spy balloon was absurd, hysterical, and an effort to divert attention away from domestic problems. Was he that dismissive to you in private?
Margaret, I don't want to characterize what he said. I can tell you what I said. I made very clear to him that China sending a surveillance balloon over the United States in violation of our sovereignty, in violation of international law, was unacceptable and must never happen again. We also had an opportunity to talk about Russia's war of aggression against Ukraine. And concerns that we have that China is considering providing lethal support to Russia in its efforts in Ukraine. And I was able to share with him, as President Biden has shared with President Xi, the serious consequences that would have for our relationship. Finally, it was important for me to underscore that we believe having lines of communication, engaging in direct diplomacy, is very important.
Does that mean their defense minister will pick up the next phone call from Secretary Austin instead of refusing it?
Well, it's one of the things that we talked about, the importance of having lines of communication, including military to military lines of communication. It's vital to making sure that there aren't miscommunications, misunderstandings, especially if you've got a crisis or some other situation on your hands.
A senior Pentagon official said last week that President Xi Jinping was caught by surprise by the surveillance balloon and that he doesn't trust his own military. Did the left and right hand of the Chinese government not know what was going on?
It doesn't matter in the sense that China is responsible for this action. And ultimately, as the leader of the country, President Xi is responsible.
There is open source reporting that Chinese companies are providing surveillance equipment to that mercenary group, the Wagner Group, fighting in Ukraine. Does the U.S. consider this to be providing military support to Russia?
We've been concerned from day one about that possibility. And to date, we have seen Chinese companies, and of course in China there's really no distinction between private companies and the state. We have seen them provide non-lethal support to Russia for use in Ukraine. The concern that we have now is based on information we have that they're considering providing lethal support. And we've made very clear to them that that would cause a serious problem for us and in our relationship.
Lethal support. What would that entail? What do you think?
Weapons.
That's ammunition. That's
primarily weapons.
Primarily.
There's a whole gamut of things that that fit in that category, for everything from ammunition to the weapons themselves.
Iran is also accused of providing more weaponry to Russia here. Mm-hmm. So they are building
we've seen
an
Iran
alliance.
There's an increasingly noxious relationship between Russia and Iran, and it's actually a two-way street. Not only is Iran providing this this equipment to Russia, but Russia is also providing military equipment to Iran, including, it looks like, sophisticated fighter planes.
So from your conversation with your Chinese counterpart, do I understand that usually when you say it's a direct conversation, that's Diplo speak for it didn't go very well, it was it was pretty heated, or did you make plans to visit Beijing in the near future?
It's Diplo speak for saying it was very important to speak very clearly, very directly about the deep concerns we have, the concerns that we have about this surveillance balloon and the entire program, the concerns we have about the possibility that China will provide lethal material support to Russia in its war effort against Ukraine.
But there was no apology.
And it's important that, again, don't want to characterize what they said, although it's safe to say there was no apology. We have to make sure that the competition that we're clearly engaged in does not veer into conflict, into a new Cold War. It's not in our interest. I won't speak to theirs, but it's not in ours.
In terms of Russia's war, 97% of its military is already engaged in this fight in Ukraine, according to the UK. They have substantial air power they haven't tapped into yet. Do you see evidence that Russia is preparing an aerial attack on Ukraine?
Russia's losses have been horrific. You're right that 97% or so of their ground forces have been engaged in this war, which is extraordinary. And the losses to date have been horrific. Public figures suggest 200,000 casualties. That is a combination of those killed and those wounded. The destruction of their war machine itself, the tanks, the armored vehicles, the missile launchers, etc., has also been extensive. In terms of air power, they tried some of this early on. Ukraine's air defenses were actually successful in shooting down a lot of Russian aircraft, so they backed off of using aircraft. That doesn't mean that they won't try to do that going forward, but at least to date, Ukraine has had air defenses that have allowed it to pose such a threat to Russian aircraft that they haven't really been flying.
I want to ask you lastly about this designation of crimes against humanity that the vice president announced. She cited horrific things like a four-year-old girl being raped by Russian soldiers, thousands of Ukrainian children being taken from their families to say that this constitutes legally crimes against humanity. President Biden has already used the term genocide. Is the State Department working on a genocide determination?
We will, as always, look at every legal possibility when it comes to going after the atrocities that Russia is committing in Ukraine. The determination that we made, crimes against humanity, that the Vice President announced today, is unfortunately starkly clear. And we've seen that almost from day one. This practice that, as a parent, is almost impossible to fathom, of literally seizing Ukrainian children, sending them to Russia, sending them to centers. There are about 43 of them that we found. There was a project undertaken by Yale University with our support that has documented this, to 43 centers in Russia and some in Ukrainian territory that Russia now holds. Some of these places are closer to Alaska than they are to Ukraine, separating them from their families and then having them adopted by Russians. This is in and of itself horrific. It also speaks to the fact that President Putin has been trying from day one to erase Ukraine's identity, to erase its future. That's what's going on, and that too is a crime against humanity.
Some of what you described is consistent with the statutory basis for the Genocide Convention. So I'm hearing what you're saying is you are potentially looking at that.
We will look at every possible determination, but okay. We're going to follow the facts and we're going to follow the law. These are very serious determinations, and we will engage in them very seriously.
Secretary Blinken, thank you for your time today.
Good to be with you. Thanks, Margaret.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort, meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Late last week, Senator Bernie Sanders stopped by the Face the Nation studio to talk about his new book, It's Okay to Be Angry About Capitalism. You talk about the alliance you formed with Joe Biden during the campaign to really shape the Democratic platform and incorporate many of your ideas. You said he wasn't as bold as you would have hoped, but he would have been the most progressive president since FDR if he had acted on that agenda. How do you categorize Joe Biden on that progressive scale now?
Well, I think the American Rescue Plan was, in fact, one of the most significant pieces of legislation for the working class of this country in the modern history of America. Build Back Better would have been transformational. It would have finally addressed the crises that the working class of this country has faced for decades, revolutionized childcare, revolutionized healthcare, dealt boldly with climate change, raised wages. I mean, it would have done a whole lot.
But the votes weren't there.
We got zero Republican support and two Democrats decided not to support it.
So in terms of how you view the president, do you think he is progressive?
I think he is a much more progressive president than he was a United States senator.
And some of the things you were able to get done and signed into law, President Biden points to them as achievements, but you diminish them a little bit in this book. You point out Medicare won't be permitted to negotiate lower drug prices until 2026. Right. The cap on out-of-pocket prescription drug costs for seniors doesn't kick in until 2025. $35 cap on insulin prices doesn't help those who aren't on Medicare. Are you saying he hasn't delivered?
No. I mean, look, this is the real world that we live in, is that you need 60 votes often in the Senate. The truth is that today, over 60% of our people are living paycheck to paycheck. So the question that I am asking is, why in the richest country in the history of the world, why don't we have a healthcare system that works for all? Why do we pay the highest prices in the world for prescription drugs? So we have seen some achievements, but given the scope of the problems and where we should be going, nowhere near enough.
We also have one of the most innovative healthcare systems when it comes to creation of pharmaceutical drugs. You are doing this.
No.
So when someone hears you lay out the problems with our pharmaceutical industry, as you do in this book, it's say, but the life-saving vaccines, for example, for COVID, they were created by the United States of America. They were created by the pharmaceutical system with taxpayer help.
Sure. Of course the drug companies produce great drugs. But one out of four people in America cannot afford the drugs that their doctors prescribe. So of course we want the drug companies to do the research and development. Mm-hmm. And by the way, taxpayers of this country spend $45 billion a year through the NIH to help with that research and development, including Moderna and the vaccine.
You're talking about Moderna. Pfizer didn't take that money. But Moderna, you're sharply critical. In fact, you're calling in Moderna's CEO to testify. You're critical of his plan to quadruple the cost of the COVID vaccine.
Well,
can you stop him from doing that?
Well, here's the story. Taxpayers, the NIH co-authored, worked together to create the vaccine.
Right.
Taxpayers put billions of dollars into the development of the vaccine, guaranteed sales for the vaccine.
As they did with many other companies.
Yeah.
Too.
All right. And then what happens after the government stockpile of the vaccine expires? These guys say, well, we're going to quadruple the price of the vaccine. And by the way, in the last 2 years, the CEO made $5 billion and his other guys made billions of dollars. Is that really what should be happening? Truth is, pharmaceutical industry is enormously greedy, charging us outrageously, uncontrollably high prices. We have got to deal with that. As chairman of the relevant committee, I intend to do what I can.
Moderna says it's instituting a patient assistance plan to give the COVID shot to the uninsured and underinsured Americans free of cost. Is that sufficient?
And you know, Margaret,
for you?
Amazing coincidence. That happened the same exact day as we announced that we were inviting them to testify.
You think your political heat made that difference?
Well, maybe it was just a wild and crazy coincidence. I don't know. But we also want to take a look at what that patient program is about. We're talking to them about that. But obviously, it's a step in the right direction.
Step in the right direction. How do you lower the cost of prescription drugs in a way that doesn't hurt American innovation? And how do you do it politically when Republicans control the House?
I think we have the basis for bipartisan work to tell the pharmaceutical industry that they really have got to stop ripping off the American people. A number of ways you could do it. The Inflation Reduction Act started by having Medicare negotiate prices with the pharmaceutical industry. Doesn't kick in for a few years.
Yep.
I think we should expedite that. Number two, of all people, my good friend Donald Trump, all right, who I disagree with on everything, had the idea that maybe Medicare should not pay prices higher than the average of what countries around the rest of the world are paying. That's a good idea, and we want to pursue that as well.
Democrats have this narrow 51-seat majority in the Senate. Both of Pennsylvania's senators are out of office right now dealing with serious health issues. And so their absence complicates any votes. Do you have any idea when, for example, Senator Fetterman will be out of the hospital and well enough to return?
We wish Senator Fetterman has gone through a hell of a year. I mean, with his stroke in the middle of a campaign and dealing with other issues. So I can't answer that.
So President Biden talks about finishing the job and the potential for running for re-election in 2024. You said you won't run if he runs. Do you believe that President Biden will face any primary challenge from the left, from the progressive wing?
I can't speak for other people. I think there's a general consensus right now that President Biden has done not everything we would like. He has done a good job. If he runs, now says that he's going to run, I will support him.
You write, the essence of the Democratic message in recent years has been, we're pretty bad, but Republicans are worse, so vote for us. Is there anyone inspirational in Democratic politics?
Sure, there's some great people who are working night and day to protect working class people.
So who's the next Bernie Sanders? Who is that voice?
I'll let you discover that. What I am extremely proud of is that there are more really strong, young progressives, often people of color, in the House now than probably in any time, certainly in my lifetime. Great people. If you ask me what I'm most proud of is that so many young people, we won the young vote overwhelmingly. Mm-hmm. And I think young people are saying, we don't want to tinker around the edges anymore, not on climate change, not on racial issues, not on economic issues. We want transformational change. And if my campaign's played a role in changing that consciousness, I'm very proud of that.
Former Ambassador Nikki Haley is running for president, as you know, and she said there should be a mandatory mental competency test for politicians older than 75. You're 81. Do you take offense at that?
What did she mean? I don't understand what you... You know, no, I think that's absurd. You know, there's a level...
Absurd.
Yeah. We are fighting racism. We're fighting sexism. We're fighting homophobia. I think we should also be fighting ageism. Trust people. Look at people. And say, you know, this person's competent. This person's not competent. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of 40-year-olds out there who ain't particularly competent. Older people. You know, you look at the individual. I don't think you make a blanket statement.
Okay. So when it comes to the current president or the former president and their age range, it doesn't concern you.
Look at what they do, what they believe in. Mm-hmm. What are they fighting for? What does Donald Trump stand for? Do you believe in that? Well, I certainly don't. What does Joe Biden stand for? What is he doing? Has he accomplished? Look at him in that way, not on age.
We're going to take a quick break, and we'll have more with Senator Sanders in 1 minute. We're back with more of our conversation with Senator Bernie Sanders. I want to ask you about some issues on foreign policy. CIA Director Bill Burns recently said that the uptick in violence in Israel and Palestinian territories reminds him of the last Intifada, that there could be an explosion of violence. Israel now is the most right-wing government it's had in years. Do you think that democracy is imperiled in Israel right now?
I do. And I am very worried about what Netanyahu is doing and some of his allies in government and what may happen to the Palestinian people. The United States gives billions of dollars in aid to Israel. And I think we've got to put some strings attached to that and say you cannot run a racist government. You cannot turn your back on the two-state solution. You cannot demean the Palestinian people there. You just can't do it and then come to America and ask for money.
Have you talked to the administration about it? They've been very careful in criticism of the Netanyahu government.
Well, I am not careful about it. I'm embarrassed that in Israel you have a government of that nature right now.
And are you going to introduce something?
We may well, yes. If a government is acting in a racist way and they want billions of dollars from the taxpayers of the United States, I think you say, sorry, that's not acceptable. You want our money? Fine. This is what you got to do to get it.
The pro-Israel lobby, AIPAC, used to be bipartisan. But these days, it's got a super PAC that has spent very heavily in Democratic primaries.
Against progressives.
You said they're doing everything they can to destroy the progressive movement in this country. Do you think the politics around this issue are constraining the White House going into 2024?
The way I look at AIPAC now in terms of their political activities, this is not even just the pro-Israel group. This is a corporate PAC, sometimes getting money from Republicans, sometimes supporting extreme right-wing Republicans. So what really upset me very much is that in many of these primaries, we had great candidates, young people, often people of color, and you had AIPAC and other super PACs spending millions of dollars trying to defeat them. And as you may know, I try to get the Democratic Party to pass a resolution that in Democratic primaries, super PAC money should not be allowed to be used.
You are proposing a new cabinet-level agency to focus on the future of work and workers. You talk about taxing robots who might replace humans. Isn't the Labor Department supposed to be doing these things?
Well, theoretically, but I don't think we're doing enough. Look, this is a huge issue. There is a revolution taking place now with artificial intelligence and robotics, okay? Mm-hmm. Millions of workers are going to lose their jobs. Who's making those decisions, Mara? You hear it debated in Congress? I don't. If there is a technology that can increase worker productivity, who benefits from that? Just the guy who owns the company, or does the worker benefit? So if we can reduce the work week, is that a bad thing? It's a good thing. But I don't want to see the people on top simply be the only beneficiaries of this revolution in technology.
So you agree with Bill Gates in taxing robots?
That's one way to do it. Yeah, absolutely.
He's a billionaire you do like.
I've talked to Bill on a number of occasions, yes. Mm-hmm.
I'm interested in that concept and some of the other things you lay out here.
Well, including... it's not just taxing the robots. It's this whole question of an economic transformation. Are working class people going to benefit from that or just the billionaire class?
So I'm told we're running out of time.
But I'm just getting warmed up, Margaret. I'm having fun.
But I have to ask you, you're going on tour to promote this book, It's Okay to Be Angry About Capitalism. And you're here talking about it. I understand we're not the bad guys you're describing in the book when it comes to media, but tickets for your tour apparently are selling for $95 on Ticketmaster, which is accused of anti-competitive behavior. You know that. Some of your Democrats are criticizing them. Aren't you benefiting yourself from this system that you're trying to dismantle?
First of all, those decisions are made totally by the publisher and the bookseller. I think there's one case where in one place here in Washington, politics and prose and independent bookstore charging some tickets. Most of them, I think, are $40, $50, and you get a book as well. So if you want to come, you're going to have to pay $40. I'll throw in the book for free. And we're doing a number of free events, but I don't make a nickel out of these things at all.
But you're okay doing business with Ticketmaster?
No, not particularly. But that's, again, I have nothing to do with that. That is, if you wrote a book, it'd probably be the same process.
Mm-hmm. So you have to operate within the system.
I do. I write a book, a major publisher, et cetera, et cetera.
Senator Sanders, thank you very much for coming in and answering our questions today.
I hope I wasn't too hard on you.
No, and I asked all the questions I wanted. Not necessarily what you wanted, but what I wanted. So thank you very much, Senator Sanders. You heard him. Senator Bernie Sanders just getting warmed up. Our full conversation is available on our website as well as our YouTube channel. We'll be right back. Next week on Face the Nation, former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice joins us to talk about China, the war in Ukraine, and more. We'll be right back with a lot more Face the Nation. Stay with us.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Welcome back to Face the Nation. President Biden heads to Poland this week, his second visit since Russia began its war in Ukraine. For more, we go now to Polish Prime Minister Mateusz Morawiecki. Good morning to you.
Good morning. Good morning, ma'am.
So President Biden will be visiting Warsaw. We know you've said President Zelensky will also be in Poland. What do you expect from these visits?
Well, I expect that there will be a very strong confirmation of our resilience and our joint efforts to defeat Russia in Ukraine. Because instead of saying, as some Western European politicians say, that Russia cannot win this war and Ukraine cannot be defeated, we have to change the paradigm and we have to say Ukraine must win and Russia must be defeated. And I believe that the words of President Biden will reassure all Europe that the United States is with us in this fight for freedom and peace.
It sounds like you're referring to the French president's recent comments. Does NATO actually want Ukraine to win this war and regain its lost territory?
I believe so. I'm absolutely sure that this is the only way how we can restore peace and stability. I cannot imagine that Putin and the Kremlin winning this war and then peace and stability is around us, because the very nature of Russia is to conquer other countries. Russia has actually summoned the worst of the 20th century colonialism, imperialism, nationalism, and this is the nature of the of Ruski Mir, as they call, and this is why it's such a critical moment in our history.
President Biden said he believes the war has to end in a negotiated settlement that's favorable to Ukraine. You said last year Poland doesn't negotiate with criminals. Nobody negotiated with Hitler. Would you negotiate with Hitler, with Stalin, with Pol Pot? Are you saying peace is not possible if Putin stays in power?
I just came to here to this interview from Munich conference. Munich Security Conference, very important platform to exchange opinions today. But in 1938, there was another Munich conference where all the leaders of the Western world succumbed to Hitler, and they believed they are bringing peace to their countries. And 1 year later, the Second World War broke out. We can, of course, negotiate, but it has to be on the conditions and under the definition presented by Ukrainians themselves. It's up to them to define what terms and conditions can be acceptable to negotiate with the Kremlin.
One of Ukraine's neighbors, Moldova, has warned that there is a plot to overthrow their government and open a new front in the war. An ally of Putin recently said that Russia should denazify and demilitarize Poland next. Do you see evidence that Russia is going to try to move into other countries, including yours?
Yes, I do see lots of fingerprints of Russian forces, Russian services in Moldova. This is a very weak country, and we all need to help them.
But in terms of Poland, you are in NATO, so the United States would have to come to your defense if you went to NATO and asked for it. There are 11,000 U.S. service members on rotation in Poland currently. I know your government's asking for more. Do you have any indications from the Biden administration that they will send more troops or make them permanent on your soil?
We are in the process of discussion with President Biden's administration about making their presence more permanent and increasing them. But I'm very grateful also for sending new Patriot systems and other very modern weapons and munitions, because this is also to some extent a proxy for presence of soldiers. But of course, the two go in tandem. I also recall the words of President Biden from his last visit in Poland, when he said that every inch or square inch of NATO's country's territory will be defended, and Russia is not going to put any inroads into those countries. And I do believe that NATO countries, we are all very much secure, but it's not only about us. It's also about creating stability around us in our direct neighborhood. And if we fall to integrate Ukraine in NATO and the European Union, Ukraine will always be a buffer zone, which is not right.
All right. Mr. Prime Minister, we'll be watching that visit. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And we'll be right back with some analysis. We're now joined by Dr. Fiona Hill, a Trump administration National Security Council advisor on Russia, and former U.S. ambassador to Russia, John Sullivan, who is now a CBS News contributor. Good morning. Good to have you both here. Fiona Hill, I'd love to talk to you first. Secretary Blinken admitted Russia's not isolated. It's getting support from China. It's getting support from Iran. So does that mean the West's main tool here, sanctions, are failing?
Well, I think sanctions was never the only tool that we had. I mean, diplomacy as well as the military support for Ukraine. And I think, you know, what we heard from Secretary Blinken and, you know, the fact that he's just been at the Munich Security Conference underscores that we're going to have to really up our diplomatic game. Because, you know, as you're suggesting here, a lot of other countries just don't buy that there's as big an issue as we see with Russia's invasion of Ukraine. I mean, they're always making comparisons with, you know, the great power competition among the United States and Russia and China and seeing it as part of that. And I think, you know, what Secretary Blinken and other members of the administration have been really striving to get across is that it's not part of that. So the United States isn't fighting over Ukraine for any kind of competition with China and with Russia. They're trying to help Ukraine liberate itself. That's the message that we have to get across. And frankly, if Russia gets away with a land grab in Ukraine, it makes the world unsafe for every country imaginable that has a territorial dispute, including, of course, all of the neighbours of China in the South China Seas and East Asia, and many other countries as well. India and China have a major dispute in the Himalayas, for example. And what we really have to do is to work with those middle powers, the countries in the UN General Assembly, to make that point that we're trying to help Ukraine liberate its territory from an unprovoked aggression.
Ambassador, you heard from the Polish Prime Minister this concern that not just the blast radius from this conflict, but that there will be some pushing of it beyond borders, maybe not overt invasion, but destabilization.
Sure.
When you were in the administration, you left in September, there was talk about the surrounding countries also being targeted by Russia. Do you think that's underway now?
Absolutely. I mean, we've seen the story earlier this week about a potential effort by the Russians to undermine the government in Moldova. We've seen overflights by Russian missiles that were attacking Ukraine that have gone over the territory of other countries that aren't parties to the conflict. But this is a longstanding concern by Poles, by Eastern Europeans that have always felt threatened by that colossus on their eastern border by Russia. Mm-hmm. They've always described it to me as, when I was deputy secretary, they felt that they were on the front lines against this Russian, imperialist Russian state.
But this feels different. I mean, when you were here with us, last time you said, when you talked to Secretary Blinken February 19th of last year, he asked you, how are you feeling? You said it feels like August 1939.
Right.
You just said the Polish Prime Minister invoked Hitler.
Yes. So what happened on February 24th last year, Putin pushed all of his chips to the center of the table. He went all in. You'll recall before February 24th, there was speculation about, there'll be maybe a limited incursion into Ukraine. Putin went all in. He went full World War II, World War I scale. This is war, and we're going all in. We're going to take down the Ukrainian government. We're going to subjugate the Ukrainian people. And by God, we're going to do with Ukraine what we wish, because Ukraine isn't a country. Mm-hmm. Ukraine is part of our Ruski Mir. We're going to do with it what we wish, what we want to. And you, the United States, you, NATO, anybody else, you can't stop us.
And he's betting on a short attention span here in the West, here in the United States. Vladimir Putin is set to give an address Tuesday. It's going to be his first State of the Nation since the war began. Very same day, President Biden is going to give a speech in Poland. What's the message you expect and should be delivered?
Well, I think what Putin is going to deliver is a message that picks up on what Ambassador Sullivan's just said. He's going to depict this as a great patriotic war. You know, they use interchangeably fatherland war, protection of the motherland. In this case, Putin has been actually trying to say that this is the third invasion of Russia after Napoleon and the Napoleonic Wars back in the 1800s and then Nazi Germany. So he's actually portraying this as an existential threat for Russia. So what we would imagine is that he's really trying to mobilize the Russian population in support of what he's depicting as the fight for their lives. Now, President Biden's going to have to counter that. We have to counter that narrative, not just in Europe. And, you know, as we've heard from the Polish Prime Minister, we've heard from many other European leaders, they do see things in this same term as a rerun of World War I and World War II, in the sense of an unprovoked aggression by a great power in Europe. But they've got to basically, and President Biden's got to convince the world, the whole world at this point, not just Europeans, that we're in a fight to help Ukraine liberate itself, and that everything that Putin is saying is a distortion of history and of fact.
Ambassador, when you talk about the war in Ukraine politically here in the United States, President Biden gets attacked by Republicans in particular for being too slow-moving to approve certain types of weapons. Fighter jets, for example, for a year have been debated about whether to give them or not. Is this too slow moving if we are actually in this incredibly important moment?
Well, it is an incredibly important moment, and I think some of the criticism has been fair. It has been, I think, the administration, of which I was a part until recently, has been a little slow, has been cautious. President Biden, the marching orders we got at the start of this conflict was he wanted to do everything we could to support Ukraine, but he didn't want a war with Russia. And that's the careful balancing act that the administration has been going through.
But
not
Vladimir
easy judgment.
Putin doesn't want a war with the United States either.
Vladimir Putin says he's already at war with the United States. He says the reason that he invaded Ukraine is that Ukraine, put up to it by the United States, was going to invade Russia. Ukraine was going to develop nuclear weapons. The United States and Ukraine were developing bioweapons. The times that he will use the word war to discuss what's happening in Ukraine is when he says the West, the United States and all of its vassals, the word they use, is actually at war with Russia. When he talks about the special military operation, mm-hmm. that's the response by Russia to the war that the United States is already waging through its Ukrainian proxies. As they say, the United States wants to fight against Russia to the last Ukrainian, and it's all made up.
And those are the words you're going to be listening for on Tuesday.
Absolutely. Fiona's absolutely right. It's going to be rallying the Russian people to support the fatherland in this, what he considers existential war that he's engaged in Ukraine.
Dr. Hill, I mean, Ukraine's foreign minister said at Munich, the true end to the war will be when Russia's president comes to Kyiv, falls to his knees and begs for forgiveness. That does not sound like Vladimir Putin.
No, but perhaps, 90 years from now, some Russian president might do that. And I'm saying 90 years because actually Ambassador Sullivan and I have some Irish heritage, and it took 90 years for the Queen, Elizabeth mm-hmm. II, to actually come and ask for forgiveness in Ireland in a very highly symbolic way for, many of the conflicts. It's not inconceivable that at some point some Russian leader, not in the immediate future, would in fact ask for forgiveness for what's been done in Ukraine. We saw German leaders after World War II, eventually ask for similar forgiveness at war memorials, including in the Soviet Union and in Russia itself. But it is true that when Russia drops mm-hmm. as a country these imperial aims, that then this will finally be over, but it won't be anytime soon.
Thank you. It's hard to believe we're a year into this conflict. We will be back in a moment.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
There is a mental health crisis in our country, and we are reminded of that frequently. For a closer look at what may feel to many like an epidemic, we want to bring in Dr. Joshua Gordon of the National Institute of Mental Health, which is the lead federal agency for research on mental disorders. Good morning to you, doctor.
Good morning.
I want to start on one of these triggers. Senator Fetterman, a stroke survivor, checked himself into the hospital with clinical depression, and it has inspired a lot of people to talk about their experiences with depression. In his case, what are the symptoms of stroke-induced depression?
The symptoms of stroke-induced depression are pretty much the same as typical depression or depression that's not associated with stroke: low motivation, sadness, challenges with sleep, appetite, energy, loss of motivation, and the like.
So what is a reasonable expectation and timeline for someone's treatment? Do they get back to their old selves?
Fortunately, there are effective treatments for depression, and those treatments do generally work for most people who have stroke-induced depression. The timeline, though, varies tremendously from individual to individual, and it's hard to make a prediction in the senator's case.
What is the typical treatment for someone these days? Is talk therapy still strongly believed in? Is medication more prescribed these days?
Well, given the typical severity of post-stroke depression, most mental health professionals would recommend a combination of medication and what we call psychosocial or psychotherapeutic interventions. So yes, talk therapy is still used. It is a very effective tool for depression, as are medications. And if the patients don't respond to talk therapy or medications, there are additional options to try.
You know, there was this recent CDC study about teenage girls, which was really sobering. It said nearly 3 in 5 U.S. teen girls, feel persistently sad or hopeless, double that of boys, representing a 60% increase, the highest level reported over the past decade. What is going on with young girls?
Well, it is truly a tragedy. It is truly a crisis, and we desperately need to do something about it on a societal level and on community levels. The what is going on question is one that we can't fully answer at this point. A lot of people think, oh, it must be the pandemic and its effects. But if you look at the surveys that the CDC has been conducting for the last decade or more, you can see the slow rise in levels of symptomatology, particularly amongst teenage girls, goes back long before the pandemic started. So there are a number of contributing factors, but on the whole, it's a complex picture that we don't fully understand.
So what are parents supposed to do?
That's a great question. First and foremost, parents need to talk to their kids. They need to listen. They need to ask questions about how they're feeling. And if they're worried, they do need to ask the question, are you thinking about hurting yourself or killing yourself? So that's the first thing, is ask questions. And the second thing, listen to the responses and try to be there for your kids. If the answers suggest that your child is having more trouble than you think, or is thinking about harming themselves, or is otherwise having challenges going to school and getting good grades, etc., then parents should seek professional help.
Doctor, thank you for your professional insight. We'll continue monitoring it, and we'll be right back. We learned the sad news Saturday that former President Jimmy Carter has entered the final stage of his life and will forego any further medical treatment. Our Bob Schieffer covered former President Jimmy Carter almost 50 years ago and brings us his insights into Carter's career.
When the former governor of Georgia decided to run for president in 1975, it was not as if America had been waiting for him with bated breath.
Jimmy who?
Jimmy Carter.
Jimmy who?
I don't know who he is.
He was so unknown that his surprise win in the Iowa caucuses brought headlines blaring the same question. But that race changed politics so much that Iowa became an obligatory first stop for presidential candidates. Carter tried to make a virtue of his lack of Washington experience. A self-made peanut farmer from Plains, Georgia, introduced us to an improbable cast of small-town characters. But his best asset was always wife Rosalynn. Carter's campaign came down to one simple promise.
I'll never tell a lie. I'll never make a misleading statement.
After the lies of Watergate, it worked, despite a campaign of dubious firsts.
The audio has been lost.
The sound went out during his debate with President Gerald Ford, leaving the two candidates just standing there for 28 minutes. Carter went on to defeat incumbent Gerald Ford, maybe not so much because of what he said, but because Ford had pardoned Richard Nixon.
I, Jimmy Carter, do solemnly swear that I...
Like his campaign, Carter's presidency began in some chaos. He bombarded Congress with so many proposals, plans, and legislation, Washington couldn't sort out his priorities. The low point for Carter came when Iran's revolutionary leaders took U.S. diplomats hostage. The conflict set off a fuel shortage back home, and Americans faced long lines at gas stations from coast to coast. A military mission to rescue the hostages collapsed in an Iranian desert, and with it Carter's campaign for re-election. The captives remained behind bars until the new president was sworn in. For all that, Carter was responsible for two extremely significant achievements. Negotiating the Panama Canal Treaty assured the canal stayed open to American ships, and American troops would not be needed to put down an almost certain rebellion. Even more important, Carter engineered the Camp David Accords, which remains the single most important diplomatic achievement in the Middle East. It took Egypt, Israel's most dangerous adversary, out of the conflict.
I would like to say, as a Christian, to these two friends of mine, the words of Jesus, "Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be the children of God."
Although he served only one term, Carter went on to become America's most active and productive former president. He visited countries around the world, serving as a mediator in settling disputes. His scientific work in Africa helped eradicate the screwworm, where it was said his was the presidential name most often remembered. His work in Habitat for Humanity revived voluntarism in this country.
When President Biden visited him in May of 2021, the pair discussed cancer research, a topic close to both their hearts. Carter survived brain cancer in his early 90s. Jimmy and Rosalind Carter have been married more than 75 years, the longest presidential marriage in history. This is Bob Schieffer.
That's it for us today. Thank you for watching. Until next week. For Face the Nation, I'm Margaret Brennan. Today's guests were Secretary of State Tony Blinken, independent Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, Polish Prime Minister Mateusz Morawiecki, former White House official and Russia expert Fiona Hill, former ambassador to Russia John Sullivan, and Dr. Joshua Gordon, the director of the National Institute of Mental Health. The executive producer of Face the Nation is Mary Hager. This broadcast was directed by Shelley Schwartz. Face the Nation originates in CBS News in Washington. For more Face the Nation, we're online at facethenation.com, and you can follow Face the Nation and CBS Radio News on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Face the Nation is also rebroadcast on our CBS News streaming network on Sundays at 1:30, 4, 10 p.m. Eastern, and again at 4 a.m. the next morning. And it's available through our apps, CBS News and Paramount Plus.
It was the biggest scandal in pop music. The stars of Milli Vanilli, the Grammy-winning multi-platinum R&B phenomenon, were exposed as frauds. But none of this was their idea. So whose idea was it? Enter German music producer Frank Farian. He saw the success of acts like Michael Jackson and Prince, and he wanted in, no matter the cost. So he devised the perfect pop heist. Two once-in-a-lifetime talents who were charismatic, full of sex appeal, and phenomenal dancers. The only problem? They couldn't sing. But Frank knew just how to fix that. Wondery's new podcast, Blame It on the Fame, dives into one of pop music's greatest controversies and takes a never-before-heard look at the exploitation of two young Black artists. Milli Vanilli set the world on fire, but when the truth came out, Rob and Fab were the only ones who got burned. Looking back now, it's hard not to wonder, why did everyone blame them and not the man pulling the strings? Follow Blame It on the Fame, Milli Vanilli, on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can binge all episodes of Blame It on the Fame early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.
Hi, this is Jill Schlesinger, CBS News business analyst, certified financial planner, and host of the Money Watch podcast. This is the show where your money is not scary. It is a show that's all about you. It's your questions that make it possible for me to provide unconventional and entertaining insights on your money and maybe more importantly, on your life. Follow Money Watch wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen ad-free on the Amazon Music or Wondery app.